This is the ProCo 360 podcast for people who love Colorado and love hearing from Colorado's most inventive and successful entrepreneurs. I'm Dave Tabor, and I'm excited about this episode because I'm with Dan Caruso, co-founder and former CEO of Zayo Group and now managing director at Caruso Ventures. He's a renowned entrepreneur and investor who has significantly impacted the telecom industry. His latest, well, this is your first book, isn't it, Dan?
Yes, first and maybe only.
First and latest and maybe only book is called Bandwidth, the untold story of ambition, deception, and innovation that shaped the internet age and dot-com boom. So it's really all about the evolution of the internet and really the pursuit of fiber and bandwidth and that whole
and the
thing.
Pursuit of money more than anything else.
Pursuit, you know what? I do want to talk about that because I was fascinated by that. And anyway, glad you're here on ProCo 360. Yeah, before we get deep into that, I really was fascinated because I got this advanced copy of your book, which I appreciated. And you talk early on about your Italian heritage, your family, bread maker, butcher, barber. I mean, even an enforcer with the Italian mob, right?
True story.
Yeah. And then there was a great story that involved a shotgun. So talk about that.
Yeah. So my hero was my grandpa. My grandpa on my maternal side. For some reason, he and I connected. So I'd go to his house. It was maybe a 20, 30-minute bike ride from my house, and I would just hang out. And my grandpa was like a true kind of Italian guy. You know, he'd go to the pool halls and play cards and hang out with the guys. So I'm in the backyard playing all on my own, small backyard that butted up against other small backyards. And his neighbor behind him, who we were all fearful of, was this guy who's maybe 5'6", tall and 5'6", wide, and just, you know, looked like the kind of mobster you see in gangster movies. He comes out of the back of his house toward me with the gun in his hand, pointing at me, and I'm looking at him, and I'm just staring, not knowing what to make. So, you know, I'm a kid, so I go running into the house, crying, trying to tell my grandparents, and my grandpa gets all upset. You know, he says, "You come with me." I'm like, "I'm not coming back out there." He's like, "No, you're coming out there." Sits me down on this bench, goes over to the guy's house, gets him out, makes him come to the bench. And he makes the guy sort of apologize. He's like, "You need to apologize to my grandson." And all that he could say is, "Yeah, I was just trying to toughen you up, kid." And then I found out later that that guy was the, you know, literally the enforcer of the Chicago Heights Italian mob. And the Italian mob in Chicago Heights was a big deal. I mean, that was where they would say Al Capone had his vacation home. So
wow. It
was, you know, shaped me.
Interesting. Well, there was another story too that I was going to, I thought shaped you. That was quite interesting. Tell the story about choosing detention versus the paddle.
Oh, yeah.
That's a very interesting, thought-provoking story.
Isn't it weird how you remember certain things, you know, that maybe shouldn't be as significant they are? And that was one of them because our school system came up with a different way of assigning people to classes. And all of a sudden it was based on how they thought, you know, how smart they thought you were. So everyone got assigned to a specific, you know, 6'1", 6'2", 6'3". So the advanced one was 6'1".
Sixth grade one.
Yeah, 6'1". And, the bad ones were maybe 6'5", or 6'6". And I got slotted in 6'2". And for whatever reason, I thought I should have been higher. I don't know why I thought that. So I was pretty upset. And I must have been sharing that with my friends. And you know how buddies are at that age. They're not not very, you know, accommodating to your feelings. So they took that as a way to make fun of me. So they called me average, Av. So I started calling Av, which really got me upset. So I got in a little fisticuffs with a friend and got thrown in a principal's office. And he said, "You got two choices, detention for a week or a smack, you know, on your ass with the paddle." He chose the paddle and I chose the week detention. And if there's anything I regret about this, it's like, "What was wrong with me, man? Just let the guy whack you on the ass and move on with it."
Yeah. So, I mean, when you think about that, is there any deep lesson around that kind of thing?
Well, the lesson for me is I was reflecting. So the book is not really my autobiography. I'm the storyteller in the book. So my story kind of goes through the book, but it's really the story about the industry. But as I had to write it, I had to reflect on how did I do what I did? Why did I do it? You know, how did I get to where I got to? And so you try to reflect. And that was one of the things, like this drive to be something more than average always was in me. I don't know why, but it always was. I needed to prove myself. I don't know to who, but I always felt the need to prove myself.
And you wish you had chosen the paddle?
Yeah. Although I don't know what I would have put the story in there if I would have.
Yeah, for sure. All right, let's fast forward a ton. You discovered your passion was assessing financial outcomes associated with new technology, business, not engineering, right? That kind of stuff. So how did you discover that? How did you make your way quickly into that?
Oh, I discovered when I started to do it. There was one professor in particular, but you know, in my MBA program where he'd have you like tear up businesses, you know, traditional business case. But this is University of Chicago before business cases were the norm at an institution like that. But for him, it was the norm. So that taught me how to, you know, really analyze businesses. But the technology in me, the engineer in me, loved to model things out, model how kind of the advent of new technologies would turn into kind of an investable opportunity and how would you know it and how would you value it. And for some reason, that just struck the chord with me. It was like a musician who gets into a certain type of music. You know, you just hit it, and it's like, wow, there's something special. And then you realize other people think you're crazy for even being interested in it.
Well, see, you kind of love spreadsheets. You love modeling things out. How did you – like, this always fascinated me because I was a statistics TA in college, and I learned that – statistics can tell any story you want them to, right? And so can models in spreadsheets, right? So, well, at least that was my experience. Like any, you can make any assumption, multiply it out through a spreadsheet, and you get the outcome you want, right? So how do you think about that as a guy who's really good at it versus people who, and we see this from entrepreneurs a lot, where they fabricate stuff within, and it just goes down the spreadsheet and here's your answer. Like, how do you think about that?
No, no, you're exactly right. I mean, but for me, it's a search for the truth, you know, the, you know, using the true discipline of financial modeling and value creation, where you're really trying to figure out what is the path forward and why. So what, you know, when you're really trying to make good decisions supported by an analytical understanding of something that maybe most people will never have versus, just as you said, people use it for storytelling. You know, look, we're going to invest this amount and it's going to turn into this and we put a big terminal value on it in 5 years and lo and behold, you know, it supports what, you know, we want to do anyways. But it's not really an honest intellectual exercise. It's more of a, you know, just, you know, check the box pitch deck.
You must have been pretty good at it because you can change a tiny number. And by the time it gets to the end of the spreadsheet, it can tell whatever you want for growth story, for value create. I mean, right? I mean, honestly, when you say you have to be truthful in your, you know, what were you calling it? A search for truth.
Search for truth.
Yeah.
That's different than being truthful in this context. Search for truth is where you're trying to discover something that's useful. You know, I'm trying to discover something that is an intelligence, an insight that will give me an advantage when I'm trying to make a present day decision.
Versus proving a point, versus proving
versus just saying, you know, hey, I want to do this and I'm going to, oh, you need a model. Okay, here's your model. Lo and behold, it justifies it. And I tell a couple of stories in the book, one in particular that, you know, one of the guys I respect the most and has presented a really positive book, but there was a specific story where they were using a model where it was all based on kind of what I characterized it was based on completely unknowns, yet he wanted to make a big point that we ended up spending billions and billions of dollars, you know, based on. And I knew it because I knew how the model worked. I'm like, there's – and he would talk about the model in this glowing way, deep sophistication. Most people didn't understand it, so they thought it meant something. I'm like, that means absolutely nothing, and how can no one be figuring this out?
Well, I guess, you know, if you're leaning into your model and nobody – I mean, look, how hard is it to look at someone else's spreadsheet or model? I mean, you can't tell what's going on unless they talk you through it. And by the time they do, right, it's like, okay.
So, well, it is an important part of investing, especially – you know, and I know when you're doing venture investing, you know, models – you still have to use financial analytics, but it's a little different because you're kind of testing the art of what might be as opposed to the other extreme is the Warren Buffett extreme, which you're really trying to model cash flows that are – a lot more predictable, not perfectly predictable, and you're trying to look for where the market might misunderstand kind of a company. And you do that by focusing on the cash flows and what the value really is likely to be down the road. And at the end of the day, every business is really worth what its cash flows will be, you know, discounted back. But, it, you know, you may not know what the cash flow is going to be, but at the end of the day, that's what it's going to be worth, whether you know it or not. And if you could gain insights on that before other people, you could, you know, be a billionaire.
That's a good way to put it. Although, you know, you look at valuations in some of these companies, you're like, how could they ever generate that much cash? you know, ever.
Well, that's exactly what they're saying about Google about 10 or 15 years ago and Amazon about 20 years ago. And now they're printing cash like crazy. So, yeah, you have to see through a lot of things. And it's a lot of those are gut calls. But at the end of the day, when you look at a company like Google, that's a perfect proof where you couldn't have made any sense of its ability to generate cash when it was giving away everything for free, but people were valuing it very high.
Yeah.
But as the picture became more and more clear, and then it became a cash flow machine, now it's reinvesting a lot of cash on new businesses.
Yeah.
But the cash from the core business is so strong and so predictable. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It gives you a foundation for value.
That's a good point. All right. Let's dive into your book. Okay. And I want to talk about bandwidth. And it's subtitled The Untold Story of Ambition, Deception, and Innovation That Shaped the Internet Age and Dot-Com Boom. And it sort of revealed, at least to me, it revealed a fascination for how the whole industry unfolded. Like, where did that fascination come from? Was that pursuing value?
Yeah, well, one, I've lived the whole experience, and a lot of other people did too. Maybe not from the same vantage point I did. I had the uncanny fortune of being with many of the most iconic companies through this crazy 35-year story, and in a critical seat, throughout, but particularly in the last 10 or 15 years, where I became one of the, if not the leading kind of person. Leading the reconsolidation of the space. So I got to see it all and much of it firsthand. And I needed the story to be told. I needed it not just for myself, but I needed to be told for all these thousands of people that were part of the story, some with relatively small roles, some with big roles, but nowhere we could look back and point to and say, this is what we did. And we know we created the infrastructure and the internet. We all know we did that. Yet, the world doesn't know it. They think Yahoo did or Mark Cuban did, and they didn't do jack shit compared to what we did. And I feel so good about getting the story down in a way that, it has a positive arc to it, but there's certainly some big down points. There's people went to jail and things like that.
Yeah, there were some messy parts. In fact,
very messy.
You told the story about Jim Crow. You said, well, this wasn't the messy part. This was just about whether you're a believer or not. And he was an early believer, as you called him, in the internet, and said to you and others, you can view the internet as a trend making you an old dog and not be employed by then his company, MFS Communications. And it seemed like he gave you the choice, get on the bus as a believer or get off the bus, and you chose to be on it, right? I mean, what made you that certain at that early stage in your career, this was like, this is it, I'm on?
Yeah, maybe that's the power of leadership because, Jim was very compelling, and his right-hand person was a guy by the name of Royce Holland, who was legendary in industry as well, very different than Jim. But they made you believe that we were the underdogs, and we were going to conquer the big monopoly Bell system. And then this thing is coming along called the internet, and this internet's going to take over the world, and we're going to be right in the helm, and we're going to make that happen. And you know what? We did all those.
Yeah. And so you feel like you went along because you believed in him, or did you have some vision of the internet yourself from the bit you'd seen so far?
No, back then I would have to say I believed in them. I can't say I had an independent vision. I was an execution guy, and I was one who was getting all the shit done, running big organizations, but getting the day-to-day stuff done. So I wish I would have had more time to be strategic and thinking big thoughts back then. But for me, it was how are you going to get that capacity turned up, how are you going to get that network built, how you get a system in place that allows you to run the business well. And it was only as, the years progressed where I had time to step back and reflect.
Yeah. Now, there was, and I mentioned it for a second earlier, but in the high growth days, and you shared a bunch of stories about how greed was driving just crazy unethical behavior, illegal decisions, and so forth. And you told the story of Bernie Ebbers of WorldCom and others. I mean, cooking the books, which essentially meant they were doing illegal accounting tricks and all that. You were even asked to become part of that, and you turned it down. But you were in a world where illegal accounting was going on, and, how did you, what was it? Maybe it was your Italian hair. What was it that said, I'm not going down that path? Because a lot of guys were.
I credit University of Chicago for that, in particular my professor, Steve Kaplan, who eventually joined the Zayo board, and he does a case study on Zayo at University of Chicago, the business school. But the fact that we would take these businesses apart and really focus on, how would you really assess the value of this business, where it's coming from? And there was at least one case study that had to do with the books being cooked. So you had to see through that and say, okay, this isn't really revenue growing at the pace they say it is. This is stockpiling of inventory that they're calling sales. And once you figure that out, you're like, okay, this business isn't worth anything. So that must have been on my mind. But what was interesting is, WorldCom is the biggest fraud in history, bigger than Enron, happened about the same time. And when it all started to be uncovered, which is a very interesting story we cover in the book, but when I was researching it and looking back, my insight into it, which happened in 1996, the WorldCom fraud didn't get uncovered to about 2001 timeframe. But when it all got researched, understood, investigated, they traced it back to beginning in 1996. So when they were asking me to do what they asked me to do, that must have been when they were first starting to get desperate and starting to cook the books. And they wanted me to be an expert witness in something they wanted to do that just wasn't right.
Wow. So you're if I'm hearing it right, you were exposed to what, like a case study that involved fraud before you were put in a position to.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if you if that helped you discern, like, that you were getting pulled into something.
Yeah. Oh, I knew I was getting pulled into something.
Because
what they were asking me to do, just there was no way you could explain it being right. So I said to the CFO, Scott Sullivan, who ended up spending years in jail, I said, Scott, I'm not comfortable doing this. This doesn't make sense. And he said something to me along the effect of, well, Arthur Anderson is there. The partners in town were their only account. They'll do all the heavy lifting. They just need an expert to cite, based on who knows what's really going on. I'm like, yeah, but what you're asking me to be an expert on, that makes no sense. And I knew business then too. I wasn't just a tech guy. So I knew the business, what they were doing, the accounting of it. So I thought about it and came back and just said no, knowing I was severing my career there. But thank God I did.
Wow, yeah. Otherwise, we might have been talking through bars.
Yes. So. I mean, literally.
Yeah.
Literally.
I know. And did you, like, when you said no to that, did you say no to something that seemed shady, or did you say no to something you knew was flat out wrong and illegal?
That's a good question. Somewhere in between the two, because there was no one to ask. I couldn't even ask my boss. This is my boss knew I was talking to him, but it's like, hey, they want to talk to you about something, go meet with them kind of thing. And my boss was, turned out being the CEO of WorldCom for a while there. So he was in the top three or four guys. And another guy who was sort of my boss too was vice chairman of the company and respected him a lot. So, this wasn't like, I wasn't in the bowels organization and I was newly acquired by them, but a very, very senior role at the time. But I knew it was, I knew it was wrong. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
Sensed it was wrong, but sensed it enough to kind of say, I'm not going to get myself in the middle of that. There's just something not right about that. It seemed like a deception, whether I thought at the time it was illegal or not, who knows?
Yeah. A lot of people though did. And I think, everybody's looking at each other like, oh, don't worry, the accounting firm will catch it. Or if they didn't say it's wrong, it's probably not wrong. And
well, the unraveling of it, the uncovering of it is a fascinating story. And the person who is most credited for beginning to uncover the fraud ended up as Time Magazine Person of the Year, one of the three Time Magazine Person of the Year, which is crazy because she was an internal audit person in WorldCom, two or three levels down from Bertie Embers. But she took it upon herself, like she was hearing things and seeing things.
She was digging.
Yeah, digging, got her team together covertly. And went to work to try to uncover what was going on, and that's what really led to the fraud being uncovered.
That experience, and then of course it started when you were in school to actually sort of have an eye for this stuff. But when you look, because you're an investor now in tech companies and you lead investments and so forth, do you look and as these companies start to book revenue and do these things, do you look differently than some of your peers and colleagues who maybe don't have that experience of like being a watchdog at all?
Yeah, I think we're the difference. Less about that. Certainly if I saw something that, seemed deceptive, that's a different matter. But where I come at it differently, and it's sometimes very frustrating, is because both CEOs, not because they're being, deceptive, but also sophisticated investors, which I question maybe a little bit more, they often are looking for that shortcut, kind of what you were talking about earlier, telling a story, slapping together some numbers, you know, creating, you know, this perception of value. And that's part of what you have to do when you're an early entrepreneur, but you better be basing it on something that is of durable value, that you're really doing something valuable, important, that will last over time. Mm-hmm. Because sooner or later, you know, the dust is going to settle, the wave's going to go out, and you better have something. And if you don't, you can't say, well, we're 10 times our revenue, or we're 20 times our, you know, EBITDA, or three times the investment. Yeah. It's like, did you build something, a business that's valuable or not?
Yeah.
So keep focusing on that point, not storytelling.
Yeah. You write, most of the leaders in the industry who remained never fully grasped the difficult lessons that needed to be learned. I did. So what are two or three of those difficult lessons that you learned that you feel like others didn't?
Yeah, probably, you know, there's a number of them. And I do, again, the book is not a, you know, here's how you manage your business type book.
Yeah.
This is a story about bandwidth and all these other characters. But a part of it was my transformation into being a CEO and trying to figure out how I'm going to build a real business out of this mess that got created. And there's a number of things there, but probably the most fundamental is we all talk about value creation. You know, what's my job as a CEO? It's to make, you know, to create value for my shareholders. You know, everyone has a mission statement. What no one seems to have stopped back and realized is we have no way of measuring that. Okay. There's no way of measuring. Now,
What do you mean there's no? Of course there is. It's what? You multiply the share times the price, and that's the value, right? Well,
that if you're a public company,
yes,
that's what the public is placing as a value on your firm. But you already said earlier that, you know, that moves around all the time. That's a estimate of value at a point in time. But if it, you know, a CEO and the investors will always say, wow, we're undervalued, and then the stock gets dropped in half. Oh, the market doesn't understand our story. But when you're private, you don't have that. But even when you're public and you have that, can you independently measure the value of the business? And can you measure the value of the business today versus a year ago? And can you forecast the value it's going to be a year from now? And it always bothered me that no one was even trying to do that. But then as I started working with private equity, what I realized is they do that all the time. Yet they don't realize that the same way they do it can be applied in the operation of the business. So, you know, I developed this methodology that's really just mimics how private equity companies do it, but applies it in an operational model that I call equity value created. And we use that as a day-to-day tool. And my early investors, I mean, they swear by it. They have trouble getting their other companies to do it because it's way outside the norm, but it was the basis of everything we did. And you know, if you really, I have a, in an appendix of the book, I include, you know, how it works, but I guess is very few people will focus on that.
I did not read that part of the appendix.
Almost no one will.
But I want to. But it, what it really sounds like is that it. I don't know. This theme that you keep coming back to is sort of like, almost like truth versus fiction. You know, is it real or is it what somebody wants it to be?
Yeah, and not unlike Buffett. You know, in every chapter of my book but one,
I know you reference Warren.
It starts with a quote from Warren Buffett, and the last page or two of the book really talks about. You know, the big lesson learned is the Warren Buffett lesson, you know, focus on durable cash flows.
Which I found so interesting because all of your businesses are tech, and he's famous until recently for, you know, eschewing tech. Now, of course, he got into Apple and he got into other things, but for a lot, you're right. So I just found that quite grounding in a way.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, everything has been tech at one point in time.
Yeah.
I mean, railroads were tech when they were new and you know, oil was tech when it was new. And so he focused on businesses that have gone through a maturing cycle. So we say that they're not tech anymore because they're the everyday norm.
Yeah.
But at that point, they start turning into, you know, how do you understand the cash flows of the business? So he likes when cash flows are more predictable. But if you can see well before that, like a Phil Anschutz, I can see that there's going to be predictable cash flows that come out of this, but I got to spend 10 years building a business first.
Yeah.
That's where a whole different type of value creation opportunity exists,
yeah,
which is what I enjoy.
Cool. All right, let's take a quick break. You're listening to ProCo 360, named Best Colorado Business Podcast the last 4 years. I'm your host, Dave Tabor. This is the podcast for people who love Colorado and the stories of Colorado businesses and entrepreneurs. My guest today is Dan Caruso of Caruso Ventures. Hey, thanks to our sponsors, Kinsley Meetings. And Kinsley Meetings is ProCo 360's longest running sponsor. They're growing based on a great reputation for planning and conducting meetings with lots of variables and all over the world. Also via technologies, thanks to them for hosting ProCo 360 and all the help your great team gives me managing the site. Finally, Colorado Biz Magazine and our partnership is one of building our audience together. Oh, and I don't want to miss Denver Angels. You probably know Denver Angels, don't you?
Yes, I do.
Dan. And we partner to feature great Colorado companies. So go to ProCo360.com and check out all these partners. All right, I want to talk a little bit about how you grew into the role. I'm going to read a long quote, forgive me, okay? Right from your book, though. My rapid rise was fueled by a relentless desire to succeed no matter the cost. I had sharp elbows, low patience, and poor EQ. Colleagues had mixed feelings about me. They saw me as intelligent, driven, and successful, but also as ruthless, callous, and insensitive. Your nickname became the Bear, and your podcast even now is called The Bear Roars. So to what extent are you still that guy?
Oh, I'm. You know, you evolve as a person. You know, you grow as a person. You mature as a person. So I would say the Bear Roars a lot less frequently now than in the heyday. You know,
are you an empathetic bear?
Now I am, but I don't know if I even knew what empathy was back then. Yeah. You know, one thing I also had to kind of come to grips with, and I think other people do too, is you know, you got to look back and recognize most people who have achieved significant success, it was a rocky road to get there. You know, this image of the CEO is a great communicator and empathetic and, you know, brings everyone along with them. I mean, think of the greatest CEOs of our lifetime. They all have big flaws.
Some of them were just flat out dicks.
Yeah, most of them. So you almost got to like, you know, look back and forgive yourself, you know, is what I learned for maybe how I did things. But if, you know, but you only can do what you can do. And, you know, you're born with, you know, for me, I had to overcome kind of adversity. You know, I didn't have mentors. I didn't have kind of role models of this type. So I had to figure things out as I went along. And
your role model was a neighbor with a gun.
Yeah, exactly. So I had to, I had to outwork most people. And, you know, I always had this sense of urgency and I wanted people who would work alongside me just as hard and, you know, just as thoughtfully. And, you know, what I learned over time is, you know, maybe not everyone was cut out of that same cloth. And I kind of wish I would have handled some things differently, but I wouldn't be talking to you today if I didn't go through that.
Yeah. I mean, I remember the days when I was a young manager, I hired into a management training program and started managing people. I look back and with some level of embarrassment over how I conducted myself, you know, but that's part of life.
Yep.
So, hey, I want to talk about the formation of Zayo Group because it really is fascinating. Talk about the concept of fiber orphans because that was really the foundation for Zayo, wasn't it?
Yeah. I use a tequila analogy. So
you fire away.
You look like a tequila drinker.
I do drink tequila now and then, yeah.
Yeah, I remember when you were a lot younger and you drank a lot of tequila and then had a really bad experience like most of us have had at one point and you swore off you'd never drink tequila again. And you know, as time went by and you reflected, you
said, forgot all about that.
Yeah. And then, you know, you're like, well, maybe it wasn't, you know, the fact that it was tequila, it was the fact that it was bad tequila. And it wasn't the fact that it was tequila, it was a lot of tequila, you know, it was those kind of things. So when the crash came and everyone lost, I mean, this is the biggest crash in the history of the world. You know, the bandwidth bust is the biggest kind of bust ever. I mean, trillions of dollars were lost. So investors, not only did they lose money, but they were embarrassed. They didn't want to talk about it. The press didn't want to talk about
it.
Those years would be 2000, starting in 2002 and progressing, you know, until after Zayo was formed. Because when Zayo was formed in 2007, the length of time it takes you to go back to tequila is directly correlated to how bad an experience you had. And this was a bad tequila experience, the worst ever. So, you know, even, 3, 4, 5, 6 years into it, you know, most institutional investors, if you brought up the topic of fiber in your, you know, investor committee meeting, they'd tell you to get the hell out of the room and take your resume with you. So we recognized, you know, that that was the time to buy. You know, you had all these fiber, because the internet wasn't going away. The internet was continuing to do everything we thought the internet would do, and more bandwidth was needed. And what I saw was a few things. One, that these fiber businesses that were built, they largely kind of found their way into accidental owners, and maybe it was one city of fiber network or three cities or one route or four routes. So I called them fiber orphans with accidental owners who were starting to run the business, and they were starting to work, and they were happy because they were making money and they got it on the cheap. They weren't anxious to exit necessarily, but they weren't long-term holders either. So the whole thesis was, hey, let's pull money together and let's start, you know, buying these up while other people are still getting over their hangover. And hopefully we get enough together before they wake up that we built a platform. And that's what we did.
Hmm. And was the platform designed to interconnect into one big network initially? So you're buying these little fiber orphans all over the place, right? But the idea is ultimately to connect them, right?
Yeah, but it was a leap of faith because we weren't going to connect them by rebuilding a bunch of fiber routes. You know, we weren't going to make the mistakes of the past. So you didn't know what you were going to get. So can you get a critical mass enough of assets that you then start to connect them together and then, you know, keep building from there? And, you know, news in the press today, I don't know if you saw this, but you know, Zayo, my company, no longer part of the company, but I am an investor. It was announced that another company that's heavily featured in the book is Crown Castle, the tower company that acquired a lot of fiber assets. Well, a bunch of business press reported today that Zayo is rumored to be the front runner in acquiring those fiber assets, which would make Zayo, you know, 50% bigger all over again, and even continue on with the vision. So at that point, you know, the two companies I was most part of have most of the fiber that exists for bandwidth purposes in the U.S.
So now how does it work? If you own the fiber, then how does the money flow? Who's paying whom what?
Well, your customers can be anything from the big tech companies to the big financial institutions to cable TV companies to other tech enterprises, and they need bandwidth. They need to kind of put a big pipe into their wherever they're at, their
they
data
hook
center.
They can pay you by the data flow. I'm sure Netflix would be one of those.
And Netflix, big customer. All those are big customers. It's how the internet flows.
Yeah, and so if they go through, I guess, a backbone pipe into whatever the networks, everybody where there's data moving is getting paid, right?
Yes.
Just based on the volume.
Yes.
All right.
Yeah, it's maybe an oversimplification, but yes.
Oversimplification is good for me.
Yeah. It's like how do you get paid for electricity when you plug into the wall while there's an electric company?
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
Is that a fair parallel?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
All right. I want to talk one more thing about the book. And I was struck, and you alluded to this a little bit earlier, but I was struck that it wasn't until Principle 10, which is the last principle of your operating manual in the book's appendix, and this is on page 362, that you talk about a focus on customer being in balance with a focus on value creation and on investors. So that struck me because every other business book, virtually every, talks about the need to focus on customer, and you didn't do that until page 362. What is that about for you?
Yeah, well, first of all, the book's not about, you know, how to run a business. The book's about this crazy story of bandwidth.
So fair.
That's why this is in the appendix, not in the book itself. And to me, it's there's three stakeholders in a business, maybe four, but I'll focus on three. And they feed off each other. You can't be all about a customer and not about your investors, because sooner or later, you know, your investors aren't going to be happy, and therefore your customers won't be happy. And you can't be all about your investors and your customers, but not about your employees, because the team is the one who delivers. So you have to find the right balance in my mind between, you know, and that sounds basic, but so many, you know, I'll say people in the business world, not necessarily leaders, but employees want you to be one or the other. You know, investors want you to be investor focused. Everyone, you know, at a minimum gives lip service that you got to be customer focused, and you do. Mm-hmm. And everyone wants to be focused on employees, but what you don't realize is if there's any imbalance between those three, you know, it's like having one leg of your stool that is broken, you're going to fall over.
So would it be fair to conclude that you were focused on customers as much as, but this is really the story of value creation, as opposed to, yeah, as you said, like how to run a bandwidth business.
Yeah, this is a story of like this, how, where this infrastructure internet came from. That is the such a fascinating story. So many characters that are household names in the business world played major roles in this, and you know, some to great successes and some to great failures. And it's the arc of it's a hero story. One of the people who got exposed there in the end said, "This is really two hero stories in one. One, it's a hero story about the industry that you know didn't exist and then began to exist and had great success, fell apart, and had to rebuild itself. Then it's your hero story that is kind of shadowing that along the way, and they kind of feed off of each other. So it really is kind of a celebration of all that a big we, investors, employees, a big we went through to create this infrastructure.
To me, it's also, I think, a great lesson in, you know, the same thing Warren Buffett did is what you did. You look for value that others don't see. What's the phrase when people are selling your book? What's the fear when people, what is that? What you use it in your book?
Yeah, it's be greedy when others are fearful and be fearful when others are greedy. And, you know, there was a stage where greed took over, you know, and that caused the big, you know, lead up to the boom and then the bust where it was all about greed. And then, you know, the time we started Zale and other people, you know, I feature others as well, not just what we did.
Yeah.
Where, you know, you were greedy when others were fearful. You were taking advantage of the fact that they were suffering a tequila hangover, and maybe you were too, but somehow you persevered on your way through.
Yeah. All right, let's talk a little bit about Crusoe Ventures. What are you doing now?
Yeah, so, you know, Crusoe Ventures is a single-family office, but very focused on Colorado, both from a tech investing standpoint. So we do a lot of direct investing in primarily in businesses that are Colorado-based. But we also do a lot of things to support the broader community. There's a foundational aspect to it as well. So as I look back at my kind of next chapter of my legacy, I wanted, you know, to give back. And I want to, so when you say, you know, there's different ways of giving back, the one that resonates more with me is helping others who are primarily Colorado based kind of make a big difference, not just for themselves, but for the community around them. So, you know, that's where I tend to try to focus our time.
Yeah.
Now, when we invest to make a great return on investment. Ah. But, you know, if you're supporting entrepreneurs in Colorado, you're helping them create something of value in the process.
Well, sure. And that helps the state, helps the community, helps all of us who want our families and friends to have great jobs and careers. And I've had a couple of your the companies you've invested in on ProQuote 360, Atom Computing.
Yes.
Outside Magazine. Well, Outside Inc.
Outside Inc. Yes.
But you've got some other super cool companies.
Yeah.
So are the leaders that you're seeing emerging today that you want to invest in? Because you do invest in the leaders, right? Are they different from the way you were when you were at that age and that stage of your career?
Well, I want to focus on what you just said, because you said it kind of casually. You do invest in the leaders as if it's so obvious that's what you should be doing. But you're 100% right. And yet, you know, I think we all have to stay focused on that. I mean, the leaders, particularly in, well, I think any company, in fact, even outside of companies in entertainment and sports, the leaders are, you know, are so, so important to the success of the team or the success of the movie or the success of the business. And sometimes in business, you kind of say that, but you don't really take it to full heart. Like, is this leader or core group of leaders, you know, are they going to have the tenacity, the passion, the skill set, the intelligence, the whatever it takes to produce a great outcome? Because if it's a great idea and you don't have that type of leader, the probability of success is small. You know, a good idea with a great leader is far better than a great idea with a good leader.
Have you chosen to invest in good ideas with great leaders? Or do you wait for great, great?
Well, you can't wait, you know, you can't wait for like, you know, the stars to align. So you always got to find that right balance. You know, when I reflect back of what we invested in the last 3 years, I would say I haven't put as much focus on the leader better be great as I should have, because some of our leaders are great and what they're doing is phenomenal, and some of them aren't great. And I'm like, you kind of knew that. Why did you invest? And you got to double down on this notion that, you know, you're investing in the leader first and foremost, not a leader with a bad idea. That's probably not a good leader.
Yeah, of course.
So you got to believe in the idea and what they're doing. but you really have to back the leader.
Yeah. Well, thinking back, all the way back, like, what do you wish you had known as a young man at the beginning of your journey that would have made life so much better?
Relationships. You know, when you look back now from the vantage point I'm at, and you kind of turn around and say, okay, what have I done? What you always come back to is the people you've done it with and the shared stories you have, the shared experiences. And, you know, as we talked about earlier, you cringe at some of them and you rejoice at others. And if I would have known then what I know now, I think I could have found a way to accomplish what I accomplished and been, you know, had a little bit more EQ in the process and put a lot more value on kind of relationships that, you know, would exist for 30, 35 years. I mean, I still hang out and am close friends with people who I met 30 years ago in business. And, you know, if I would have known it then, I'd been like, man, cherish every single relationship you have, because some of these are going to be with you forever. And why waste any of the time with those that isn't positive?
Do you think you would have been as successful if you had had a higher EQ early?
Well, you are who you are, you know. You can't really dial those things, but but you know, your question was if I was able to go back in time and retweak things, I would have challenged myself to not give up anything relative to, you know, choosing a very aggressive path forward and the tenacity, but try to do it in a way that was, you know, maybe a little smoother at times.
All right, last question. What's your favorite advice to give?
Well, when it depends to who, but, you know, if I put that in the context of someone who's early in their career, what I'd like to tell them is a few things, but I'll focus on one, and that is if you think you want to be a part of a startup, you know, think of it from the context of maybe you don't want to start with a startup. Maybe you want to start with the scale up, which is what I did, not knowing I was doing it. But I went with a group of people who already started a company, already had success, already were scaling up, and I got to ride this roller coaster versus if I would have gone with a pure startup, could have wasted 3 or 4 years. And yeah, I would gain some experience and a few relationships, but you know, a failed startup, you could lose 3, 4, 5, 6 years and be like, man, you know, I got to start all over again. And I learned some, but maybe I didn't learn enough versus a scale up. You're building relationships. You're coming up with ideas. You're getting plugged into an industry. Then you could go and take that. And if you want to start up.
Yeah. I would think some people would embrace that advice. Others would think, the romantic exciting notion of a startup, like, you know, I want to do it. Yeah. So I guess they just have to learn what they have to learn.
Well, maybe not. I mean, we know stories of
people
that's
who first time
quit college and went to start something
worked
up.
Worked okay for Gates and Dell, didn't it? Yeah. So, all right. Well, let's wrap up with that. Appreciate it. Yeah, I'm your host, Dave Tabor. Today on ProCode 360, you've been listening to my conversation with Dan Caruso, former CEO of Zayo Group, now executive director of Caruso Ventures, and author of the recently released, will be releasing.
It's ordered right now, released next week.
All right. Probably by the time you hear this, you'll be able to buy it. Bandwidth, the untold story of ambition, deception, and innovation that shaped the internet age and .com boom. Good to have you on ProCode 360. That was fun.
Yeah, and Dave, congratulations for having the number one podcast here in Colorado. That's a big deal, and you, like me, are celebrating others and giving them time to tell their story. So I appreciate what you're doing for the community.
You're welcome. Thank you for that. And listeners, glad you're here on ProCode 360, where we say live, work, love Colorado, because you and I and my guests can be successful anywhere and choose Colorado. You make the show successful by subscribing to the ProCode 360 podcast. If you haven't yet, it's a huge help. Please submit a review in your app. Thanks again to show sponsors, Via Technologies, Kinsley Meetings, Denver Angels, and Colorado Biz Magazine. That's the show. Live, work, love Colorado.